Welcome back to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Centre. In this episode, recorded live in Melbourne on Tuesday, October 16th, 2018, we're talking foreign affairs with Stephen Smith. Here's our host, Sally Warhaft, to tell us more.
We like to think we're a bit psychic at the Fifth Estate, getting a former foreign minister in the seat this evening of all evenings. We're not psychic. But we've obviously got really good karma or something, because it really couldn't be a better evening to welcome him here. Stephen served in the Federal Parliament lower house for 20 years, from 1993 until his resignation in 2013. He was a minister in the Rudd and Gillard governments, including, of course, Foreign Affairs from 2007 to 2010, and later Trade and Defence. Since 2014, he's been a professor of public international law at the University of Western Australia. And in fact, he has a master's in that field particularly. So he was not only well qualified for foreign affairs portfolio, but for what he's doing now. So this is good, Stephen. He practiced as a barrister and a solicitor. So please give him a great Melbourne Wheeler welcome.
Thanks.
I'm going to start off, of course, by asking you about the just fantastical news all day with the Liberal candidate for Wentworth, David Sharma, putting out the idea of moving the embassy, the Australian embassy, from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and Scott Morrison following up saying he is open to that idea and finds the arguments in favour persuasive. What do you think might have been going on in our dear leader's mind, Stephen?
Well, the great advantage of being a professor of international law at the University of Western Australia is that you don't have to worry about following the media minute in, minute out when something's occurring. So if something significant has happened since about 9 a.m. this morning, yeah, I'm blissfully unaware of it. But I think the starting point is it's never good to make a foreign policy decision to meet a domestic political concern.
Do you think it's ever happened quite like this before? Can you think of an example with a by-election where such a significant proposal would be floated?
It's a cracker. It's a good one. And for a range of reasons. I mean, clearly, despite any denials that the Prime Minister might make, it's done for Wentworth purposes, so it's done for the by-election. That's the first point. Secondly, the fact that the Australian newspaper had a very well-sourced blow-by-blow as to this being Dave Sharma's suggestion tells you why it was done. And it's never good to mix these ingredients. And he hasn't actually come out and said we're going to move it. He's open to this consideration. So if in the event you're going to do it, you don't do it in the manner in which it's been suggested. So it's done for craven domestic political purposes, and that may well backfire both in the international relations front, because I don't think the government would have said to itself, has anyone asked the Indonesians how they might respond to this? Because today would have also been a day where the government was saying to itself, we might be able to have a go at Labor here, because what they've said on free trade agreements may have some impact on the proposed economic partnership with Indonesia. Well, that one's backfired. So first rule of thumb is, if you mix these things, they can blow up, and often they blow up in your face, and I think that's what's occurred today. And look, the good folk of Wentworth are a pretty switched on constituency and electorate, and it would have taken them a nanosecond to see through this in the manner in which I saw through it this morning in a Melbourne hotel room.
Mm. It's a particular policy area that's been bipartisan for 70 years. I can't sort of... I'm trying to think of the most recent foreign policy decision in Australia that would be as divisive as this one.
Yeah, well, you told me I didn't have to put my mind and prepare and rehearse for all of this, so I haven't put my mind to clangers of the past. But, look, both major political parties in Australia have been committed to a two-state solution in the Middle East for a long period of time. So, and we were intricately involved in the very early days in the UN and the establishment recognition of Israel as a nation state. So my side of politics, Labor and the liberal national or the conservative side of politics, have always had that as a fundamental starting point. But we've also said, you know, the Palestinian people also have a right to a nation in that area. And so we've been both parties committed to that for a long period of time, as you say. It's not impossible to see a sensible circumstance where Australia's and other nation states' embassy to Israel could be in Jerusalem. At the same time, as it's not impossible to contemplate that a whole range of nation states' embassies to the Palestinian nation state might also be in Jerusalem, just different parts. But if you're going to do that, then you want to do that in a manner and a way in which it promotes getting a two-state solution, not in a way in which it's probably more counterproductive. And so the criticism against the United States' decision to move the embassy was essentially asking the question, will this help or will this hinder trying to advance, you know, a very stalled and a deeply divided effort at a two-state solution to Israel and the Palestinians? And my judgment from afar was, I don't think this is going to help. I think there are, as I look at things, there remains a central difficulty from the Palestinian side, which is an ongoing refusal to accept Israel's right to exist in peace and within defined borders. And that has to be, in my view, the starting point. Equally, I frankly don't think that the Netanyahu government has been a promoter of trying to advance a peace process. So there are difficulties on both sides. And whilst there are strong views firmly held in Australian society, I think we also have to understand that whilst we are a friend of Israel and also a strong supporter of a two-nation state solution, we're a middle player here. We're not a major player. And so whilst on the one hand the US has said we're going to move our mission to Jerusalem and have done so, I think there's only one other nation state in the world who said, yeah, and we're going to do that as well.
Guatemala,
so,
I think.
So I don't think this is an area where Australia wants to be the pointy end of a spear, because I don't think in the end that is a helpful contribution to trying to move the process forward, however flawed, bitter, divided and difficult that is. It's still not impossible to embark upon a process where, with land swaps and the like, you can effect, you know, a two-nation state solution, and that has to be our continuing ambition.
The Indonesian response, and Indonesia's a place you still follow very closely, felt to me today like it really is just getting started. Can you tell us what would be at play and what the state of that sort of relationship seems to be at the moment?
Well, what's at play here is that the Prime Minister and the government may have been thinking, we've got a by-election on in Wentworth in a few days' time.
They may have been, or they may have not been thinking at all.
Well, I'm sure they were thinking that. Mm. I don't think they were thinking, oh, by the way, President Jokowi, he's got an election in 2019 as well. Mm. And he's been working very hard to try and make sure he's not outflanked by, I'll choose my words carefully here, by people who proselytise an extremist view which is not shared by mainstream Muslim and Islamists. So he's been working very hard to not be put in that pincer movement. And Indonesia is well known as a strong supporter of the Palestinian people, the Palestinian Authority, and a two-nation state solution. So the instinct that you've seen from President Jokowi is not surprising if you know anything about Indonesia or were thinking about it, but no one on the government side would have been thinking about that. And so the card that Joko, as he's commonly known, has to play is the Comprehensive Economic Partnership or Free Trade Agreement, as we would call it. And he's played that card because he wants to get ahead of people who in Indonesia would be saying, this is terrible and shocking, we need to do something about it. In the end, in the event, the free trade agreement between Australia and Indonesia will be signed, and that's an unambiguously good thing. It won't of itself be the solution to a really inferior trade and investment relationship we have with Indonesia, which we must rectify over the next couple of decades, or will be at grave risk of our prosperity falling. But he's responded in a political way because he doesn't want to be outflanked. So he's not thinking about the Wentworth by-election, he's thinking about Jokowi presidency term two.
It just astonishes me that when you think about foreign relations, you can have a prime minister come out and do something like this, where it seems to be there's a lot more potentially to lose than to gain, where you've got a whole department that presumably are pulling their hair out all day as to why this has happened, I would guess, and where I, with no expertise whatsoever in Indonesia, was able to write down an extra question for you at, you know, 9:30 this morning before the Indonesians were awake in regard to what that ramifications might be. Well, how do these things happen?
I don't think this decision, and the decision is essentially to plant this seed, not to change the venue of our mission in Israel. I don't think the decision to put this story out there was following consultation with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. And knowing the system as I do, I think the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade would have spent a lot of today mopping up, as we say in the trade.
Is there anything else that the government is putting at risk with the relationship with Indonesia? It's such an important relationship, and it's such a difficult one at times.
To fully respond, I'll have to traverse my sort of my view about Indonesia. It's our closest neighbour, so Indonesia is closer to mainland Australia than a plane flight from Melbourne to Sydney. We tend to look at Indonesia with a lag effect, looking at the past rather than the future. By 2035, all the respectable economic indicators are that by 2035, Indonesia's share of global GDP will be the same as Japan. And you'll remember that Japan, until 2008, 2009, was our largest trading partner before it was overtaken by China. And by 2050, Indonesia will be the fourth largest economy in the world. So this is a country which, and when Lee Kuan Yew died in the last year or so, people played the clip of Lee Kuan Yew saying, I'm amazed that Singapore was a country, which it didn't actually want it to be a separate country in its own right, but that's how things transpired with the Malayan Peninsula and Malaysia. I think it's remarkable that Indonesia is a country. You've got thousands of islands, vastly diverse cultures, 200 to 300 million people. And the fact that they're not only a country, they are now an established democracy with the handover from democratic electoral handover from SBY to Joko. You've seen for the first time one elected president hand over to another. When SBY was elected for his second term, that was the first time one elected president had been re-elected. Prabowo thought about disputing the election but came to the conclusion that that was something that could have occurred in the old Indonesia but not the modern Indonesia. And the two candidates will run off again. And on balance, I think Joko will win. So I think this is a remarkable country. And you're right. If people say to me, Stephen, you've got option tomorrow, you can go to Surabaya or you can go to Sydney, well, I'll go to Surabaya. You know, I can do more good in Surabaya, I think. So this is a country where we, despite a lot of effort on the part of diplomats, some sections of Australian business, big swathes of academia and think tanks, including and in particular out of Melbourne, Monash and Melbourne, our economic relationship with Indonesia is not what it should be. I mean, we have a trade and investment relationship with Indonesia, which frankly is lamentable. And unless we grow that relationship over the next decade or so, by the time Indonesia has an equivalent share of GDP as Japan and then becomes the fourth largest country in the world, when their economy will be such that they will need to have structural outflows of investment going to other countries, if they're not thinking of Australia, we'll miss out on that investment. And two things have made Australia a prosperous country. One, we've been a great trading country, a great trading nation, wheat, wool, you know, and now LNG, iron ore, elaborately transformed manufacturers, services, and we've been an attractive place for overseas capital investment, whether it's been UK, US, Japanese, Korean, or now Chinese, because we're now a country of 25 million people with aspirations to be 35 million people by 2050, when China, India will be 1.4, 1.5, US will be 200 to 300, and Indonesia 300. So we don't have the population. And despite the great success of superannuation, we still don't have the capital capacity to do all of the investment that we need to keep our prosperity going. So where's the next big lick of investment, foreign investment, going to come from? It can only come from two places, Indonesia and India. And both of those currently, when the time comes for India and Indonesia to be structurally investing, not just individual companies or individuals investing, if we're not careful, they'll be thinking north, not south, North America, Europe, North Asia. And Australia, we only need to get a little lick of that investment to keep on seeing our prosperity grow. Because
almost everything you've said about Indonesia also applies to India, yeah. Although, of course, they're really different countries. But another thing that we have in common with both those countries is a struggle with our sort of cultural sort of diplomacy in a way too. We're just not as close, particularly with India, as we should be.
Well, yes and no. There are many people in Australia whose diplomacy, cultural affinity, hard work with Indonesia is world-class and fantastic. But to many Australians, their only contact with Indonesia is Bali, and even then some of them aren't necessarily convinced that it is Indonesia. So we've got, you know, and you can roll out all the stats you like. There are now fewer Indonesian language teachers in Australia than there were in the 1970s. You know, there are fewer Australian students and academics and researchers going to Indonesia. Having said that, the new Colombo plan, which Julie Bishop instituted, is a really terrific thing, and that's having a positive and beneficial effect. With India, by the time we get to 2050, India will be the first or second largest economy in the world. Probably the second, but it'll be China, US and India, and Indonesia fourth. And so we need to do the same thing with India. And the first speech I made as foreign minister was essentially a look west speech. India had adopted a look east policy, and I said we need to look west, which is more than just looking to Perth and Western Australia, but to Indonesia and to India. And we have a lot of things in common with India which we can utilise. You know, there's a 700,000 Indian diaspora in Australia, and in the blink of an eye, it'll be a million. So a million Indian diaspora out of a country of 25, 26 million people, that's horsepower. And a lot of that is in Melbourne, but in Perth, where I come from, we're 10% of the population. We've got 70,000 Indian diaspora. So we've got that, and that's been occurring in recent times, but really with the arrival of Anglo-Indians both before and after World War II. We're both democracies, India the largest democracy in the world. We've both suffered or benefited from Westminster-style system and British bureaucracy. I think the Indians have suffered from it more than we have. We both respect the rule of law and intellectual property and the like. So there's a lot, and we play cricket and we play hockey. And I'm very much looking forward to the next Indian tour. But our relationship, to use the cricket analogy, with India has been like a 2020 match, not a test match. Spurts of enthusiasm, and I pride myself on what I tried to do, but not the longevity which comes from a test match. You've got to be persistent, persevere, etc. And we're the mendicant in this. We're the one who's got to take the running. And Peter Varghese, who's a former High Commissioner to New Delhi and a former Secretary of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, recently published a report, which is a fantastic report, a terrific report, which says here's a roadmap for Australian business to start trading and investing in India, essentially carves it up into 10 states and 10 sectors on the basis that you can't, a country of 1.4 billion people, with a strong, they're a strong federated system like we are, a lot of economic activity occurs at the state or local level. And so that's the best roadmap we've had for India. But I think in the end, we'll need a qualitative change of approach to both India and Indonesia before we actually master what we need to do to make sure those economic, trade, investment and enterprise relationships are of the quality that they need to be.
Because we just keep having this same conversation. The Peter Varghese report that you mentioned, one of the things he wrote in that report was this idea of starting to think about how our trade relationship, our economic relationship with India and, in fact, with other countries as well with India can be driven towards more social equality. And when I read that, I just thought, how do we even get close to that kind of substantial thinking when, with the list of things that you just talked about that have been talked about for decades of commonality, why it seems to be such a stumbling block and yet such a just tremendous opportunity? It's a mystery.
Well, look, I've tried to think sort of deeply about this. Like at the University of Western Australia, sure, I do my international law, but I'm also a UWA director on a think tank there. And so I've spent, and we look at what we call the Indo-Pacific, so which basically acknowledges that India is on the rise as a great power, so is Indonesia. So instead of talking about things in terms of the Asia-Pacific, which was the old sort of Paul Keating and Gareth Evans nomenclature, we say, look, it's not just US and China, North Asia and the Pacific. Economic growth, economic power, therefore strategic power, military prowess, strategic horsepower and weight and heft is being dragged sort of south and west. So you've got to look at the Indian Ocean as well. And so I've said to myself, you know, what is it which has stopped Australian businesses and industry investing in Indonesia and India in the same way they have in Japan, Korea and China being the best example in terms of a developing country with a difficult market. What we had in China, which we don't have in India or Indonesia and won't have, is that through the creation, post-World War II creation of our Northwest Shelf and Northwest iron ore and LNG industries, we had a minerals and petroleum resources export industry which went to China. So the Chinese said, we're developing our economy. And these conversations started when Whitlam gave early recognition and then Hawke followed up. And so this has been, again, a unity ticket of both major parties, and Howard did the same thing when he was in office. But we've created a northwest of Western Australia iron ore exporting industry and a northwest of Western Australia and Northern Territory LNG exporting industry. And they've gone to China because China said, we need your energy and your inputs. Can you be a safe, assured, quality, reliable provider of that? And so you've got these backbones, a minerals and a petroleum resources backbone. So people go off to Shanghai to try and do a iron ore deal or an LNG deal. So lawyers are there. Then there's got to be a place for the expats to go and have a beer at night and to get some decent Melbourne coffee. So you have this sort of like Australian ecosystem that pops up. And then people say, oh, maybe I could go to Shanghai and sell what I sell, you know, whether it's a high-tech thing or whether it's a design or a service, whatever. So the export industry to China has given you a sort of a something off which other small and medium-sized enterprises and other industries can hang. Indonesia don't need or want our energy in the same manner, nor does India. Mm. And so that requires disparate Australian enterprises to try and break into a very hard market without having that backbone. Sure, they get good help from the Australian Mission and Austrade and the like, but they don't have that ecosystem which is there, which gives them confidence where they kick over a rock and find new opportunities and also give them support in hard times. And that's why I think we need a qualitative different approach from government, from industry and business. And there's no doubt that the China bug and the China export and the China trade has sucked a whole lot of resources out of what people were doing in both India and Indonesia. And so you find over a period of time, Western Australia, for example, used to have 4 trade and investment offices in India. Now we have 1 because they were sucked away by other resources. The trade and investment office that Western Australia had in Malaysia was sucked away because all roads led to China. So the Chinese market has sucked in resources away from India and Indonesia. And now we need to say, well, actually, just as it was in our national interest to wake up every day in the 70s, 80s and 90s saying, what are we doing today to get those export industries up with China? What are we doing today to get a decent export and trade relationship going with Indonesia and India? Mm-hmm. And it's hard because you don't have those that backbone. And I get a lot from business saying, well, it's a tough market. And I say, yeah, it is a tough market. Is anyone saying that China wasn't a tough market when Australia decided to go in the 1970s and 80s? So there's also an element of, in a sense, forgetting how tough and how hard it was to get these things going. And that requires leadership from government and leadership from industry. And I think Malcolm Turnbull did a really good thing with the Varghese report on India. And we should do, exactly the same thing with respect to Indonesia. Not that Peter would do it, but someone appropriate to do that long-term economic trade investment study to provide a clearer roadmap for Australian business looking at Indonesia.
Look, we better turn to Trump. I don't usually call him Trump here. I call him the Vulgarian because I've said this before, he's just illegitimate to me on the basis of the way he's spoken about women, if nothing else. But because you are a former foreign minister, I wouldn't expect you to call him that. But what do you make of his presidency so far? And as a former foreign minister, do you ever find yourself thinking, oh, I wish I'd had him, you know, in
no.
my time? No.
Well, the two big sort of uncertain slash disruptive factors that we have at the moment, which sort of causes consternation or focuses everyone's mind, is on the one hand, China has gone from what we used to call the responsible stakeholder, Deng Xiaoping consensus sort of slowly model to Xi Jinping's assertiveness and Chinese core interest. And the uncertainty and disruption which comes from President Trump, when we all thought that it was going to be Clinton and that would have been fine. So my analysis is the backdrop you have is the backdrop I went through before. So just to very quickly recap, the world was changing anyway. It wasn't just US and China, it was also the emergence of India as a great power and Indonesia as the fourth largest economy. So the dynamic was changing and the world had to manage that. And just as the world got round to the US-China relationship being sort of in some form of equilibrium, then up would pop India as a third great power and we'd have to do the same thing. So all of that was coasting along quite nicely in sort of strategic terms. But then you had the disruption of Trump's election and the uncertainty caused by the Xi Jinping Chinese assertiveness. I'm old-fashioned in these things, and so to me, you know, you have to deal with the president who the United States elects. So you've just got to take what you get and deal with it. One American friend said to me, Stephen, you need to understand that the presidency, It's not just one person, it's an institution and there's a franchise nature to it. So you don't just deal with the president, you know, you deal with all of the institutions that you've come to deal with in your national interest and you should keep doing that. So my general sort of attitude from Australia's perspective about the president is unless you've got an issue that you actually have to raise with the president, just keep your head down and work with all the various parts of the franchise. And I think Malcolm, frankly, did a good job in that respect.
And Julie Bishop.
And Malcolm and Julie both did a good job in that respect. And so if you look at the way we've been dealing with the franchise, the ongoing sort of strategic and security links continue, so the defence, the strategic, the intelligence and the like, they all hum along nicely. The economic stuff hums along nicely because the US, whilst everyone sees the Chinese trade, the US is our single largest economic partner when you put investment in. And we did a study in the last couple of years which essentially said that don't just look at export, look at the proceeds from investment. And the money that American companies make by investing in Australia is six times the money that American companies make by exporting to Australia. And the money that Australian companies make by establishing in the US, investing there and selling their products and services there is four times what we make by exporting. So there's a complex investment relationship which works very well for Australia. So we've done pretty well in trying to keep our heads down. And the fact that we have a deficit with the United States in trade terms helps us a lot, because Trump sees things in basically, what's our trade deficit, plus or minus with this company? It's minus with China, therefore that's bad, therefore we have to do something about it. So we score pretty well on the, you know, the Aussies are in debt / deficit to us on the trade side, so they'll be fine, leave them alone. That's why Malcolm and others were able to make sure that we had a steel exemption on the steel tariffs. So we've done so far so good. And I think the general meaning is keep your head down. But it is disruptive. And despite the temptation every day to respond to what he might do or say, there comes, from time to time, the Australian Prime Minister or the Australian Foreign Minister or the Australian public do have to stand up and say, the President did something the other day. We don't like that. We don't think it reflects traditional US values. It certainly doesn't reflect the Australian values, and we don't like it from time. But there's no point, in my view, getting involved in a running commentary. He has he's a Teflon president because nothing sticks. Stuff that would have seen lesser mortals drummed out of public life in Australia, UK, or even China, it's just a daily thing which people just pocket that and move on. It's quite extraordinary.
The disruption from that, we don't know how much that's going to change for the future.
On the trade front, so he's whacks a tariff on China and says, I'm going to go more. The Chinese get that, you know, there needs to be improvement in the way in which they conduct themselves so far as intellectual property is concerned throughout the world. But they're really scratching their heads about what else are we supposed to do? So there's whacking a tariff, you know, in the modern day doesn't help. So that I think we'll sort of, inverted commas, escape that trade war unless it gets to a point where, because there's no need for Trump to change our relationship with them because Aussies are in deficit, tick. With China, that'll bowl along unless and until the adverse consequences of the trade war with the tariffs see a contraction in the Chinese economic growth and a contraction in US economic growth. And in my experience, reserve bankers often overreach, and we are going to see interest rates go up in the United States as a result of the last few days on the stock market. And so there's a danger of US and Chinese economic contraction, which won't be good for Australia and won't be good for the world. But there's no process of trying to resolve that sort of trade relationship that the Chinese can discern from Trump. The other danger on the security front of trade, on the security side, so far as Trump is concerned, is that close allies who've got real live issues on the security front, in particular Korea, don't actually know where they stand. And the same with Japan. So on the one hand, you can say Trump's perversely had more success at getting Jaw going rather than war on the Korean peninsula. On the other hand, both the South Koreans and the Japanese are worried that without explanation, this will end up with a deal where Trump does a deal with the North Koreans over intercontinental ballistic missiles, but nothing about short-range missiles, which is not going to help Seoul or Tokyo. So the Allies are in a state of sort of nervousness and worry, and that's what causes consternation. The, you know, uncertainty, disruption is not good for strategic relationships, not good for diplomacy and international engagement. And, you know, foreign ministers and diplomatic officials spend all of their time trying to manage that so you get a clean run at thing. Uncertainty's bad, confusion's bad, and what's occurring now is unfortunately maximising all of those adverse factors.
Does the world sort of seem to, this is a big broad one, but, you know, seem more sort of highly flammable now than it did when you were foreign minister? Does it feel like a more dangerous moment?
We always talk about what we call sort of, you know, we're worried about miscalculation, misjudgment, escalation. So that we are, I think, much more worried now about the potential for an incident to get out of control. So on the South China Sea, where, if I put on my international law cap, where the Chinese are conducting themselves contrary to international law and the Permanent Court of Arbitration have said so, but where the world's not done anything about it or been able to do anything about it. So the South China Sea, where the US, as a matter of course, will conduct what we call freedom of navigation operations, where essentially, and the US have been doing this for decades around the world, if there's disputed territory, they'll do a freedom of navigation, which is go within 12 nautical miles of the disputed territory and essentially say, this is no one's territory, this is disputed. And Australia does that from time to time, generally in conjunction with other countries. And we do it, but we don't do it every day of the week, which is essentially what the US Navy does. So there is, a heightened risk that the competition now between China and the US, that what one Navy captain does in the outblocks of the South China Sea, you know, runs the risk of escalating. And that's what we need to manage. When the US and the Soviet Union were sort of, you know, were a duopoly running the world in, strategically in the post-World War II and the Cold War, they had next to no economic relationship, but a highly sophisticated and defined military and defence communications relationship, because with the massive overabundance of nuclear weapons, the risk of miscalculation were too great. So they had a finely honed communication system, and that, you know, saved the world on a number of occasions. The US and the Chinese have got a highly sophisticated economic relationship. Their economic relationship is inextricably interwoven in a trade and an investment sense. And at one point in the cycle, Walmart was the sixth largest entity in the world that received Chinese products. You know, so you'd list various countries, the state of California, and Walmart. So heavily integrated economically, but not much of a political, strategic, defence, military relationship. And that's what we really need them to grow. The problem is, it's now coming at a time where there's competition and assertiveness, not at a time of good karma where you can try and build these things. So, yeah, I'm more worried now than I was. And the world's changed very quickly. You know, when I was foreign minister, in the Australian context, there were just starting to emerge Sky and ABC 24. So you're just starting to emerge a couple of 24-hour TV channels, so where the media was voracious for content. Now, like, there's just so much online, so much social media, so much this, so much that the decision makers just get consumed by the request for content, and that gets in the way of making good decisions. And Trump plays on this. I'm like, he rescued Twitter as a platform. Twitter was dying as a platform until Donald came along and got himself, you know, elected by a majority of college votes, not by a majority of US citizens voting.
How does our economic prosperity and dependence in our relationship with China affect our policy?
Well, I always hate answering questions with prefacing it by saying when I was foreign minister.
Yes. Or distort our policy is probably the word I want to use. But
no, yeah. I think what was true in that time. So what was true in the sort of the the late 2000s is true now, which is the business community and entrepreneurs and exporters see things, understandably, through their prism, which is don't do things which are bad for business. And that's always the mantra chant. Our security, defence, intelligence side of the shop will look at things through a completely different prism. And the government of the day has got the job of trying to sift through all of these and make a judgment which is in our long-term national and national security interests. And so often you'll make a decision where the business community will say, well, that was terrible and shocking, you know, they're angry at us now, that's bad for business. Well, that might be the case, but you've probably made, you know, a very responsible, sensible, serious, well-thought-through strategic decision. Because whether we like it or not, China is a country with different values, a different set of approaches, and for the first time we're grappling with a great power who is not, inverted commas, democratically based other than the Soviet Union. Mm. And that intermingling of the economies is what causes that frisson, because it wasn't there with the US, with Russia, with the Soviet Union, either for US or for us. And so you've always got to take the business public argument with a grain of salt. It's good intelligence. It tells you how the reaction is, but you can't make a decision from a national interest perspective just by looking at that. There's a myriad of other things. You've got to get all of the relevant information and then make your best judgment at that point in time. And it's going to get harder for Australia because I'm not saying it'll get worse before it gets better, but at some point in the cycle, there'll be an equilibrium of sorts between the US and China in our part of the world. It's not, in my view, in Australia's interest for the US to retreat. So the isolationism of Trump is of concern to me and should be of concerns to Australia. The presence of the US in our part of the world has been a positive strategic, security and economic force since World War II. I mean, we can all draw attention to a couple of, you know, well-known, high-profile, historic blunders, but it's best that there's what we call plurality or multiplicity. You know, you're better off having, to put it in sort of crass or blunt or colloquial terms, you're better off having two or three or four people running the show rather than just one, you know. Mm. So the plurality, the slight sort of contest of ideas and interests actually helps a medium-sized, large economic country like Australia, but you've got to manage that so it doesn't get into the miscalculation zone.
What are we really good at in Australia in, you know, the world of foreign affairs?
We're terrific at protecting Australia's interests. I mean, you look at, you know, we're a large landmass country and continent. So we're an island country and island continent. We're small population. We have next to no critical mass. So 25 million people, a small number of inverted commas, semi-large population centres, Melbourne, Sydney, lesser extent Brisbane and Perth on the coastal fringe. So you've got no big critical mass as a market. Yet we've managed to craft out for ourselves a peaceful society, the most successful multicultural country in the world, democracy, and we have greater levels of prosperity than we would have ever believed possible. And we've done that because we've worked out what works for Australia, what plays to our strengths. What works for Australia is that might is not right, so one country or a small number of countries running the show without recourse to any other reference point doesn't work for us, so we've been good at assisting that. We're a small country, so having a security partner like the US, that works for us, and previously the UK. But then being a country that is invested in regional and international institutions, so the UN works for us, the International Court of Justice works for us, ASEAN-related institutions work for us. The Pacific Island Forum works for us. So, you know, Peter Varghese and I have often said, you know, as we speak, And this was when he was both High Commissioner, and so, because I've known him for a while, we'd often say, you know, there'll be a meeting occurring somewhere in the world at the moment, and some diplomat in Canberra, some Australian DFAT officer in Canberra, will be agonised and worried because Australia doesn't have a presence there. So we're into everything on a bilateral, regional and multilateral basis, because, you know, you know, my old boss, Paul Keating, used to say we punch above our weight. I've never thought that was a helpful expression from an Australian perspective. We're in the top 15 economies in the world. We're in the top 15 defence and peacekeeping spenders. We're a middle-sized power with a small population, but we're a significant economy, and we should conduct ourselves accordingly, you know, and we do. So we're very good at plying all of those trades. And I think, what are our challenges for the future? I've never believed the notion that somehow Australia can be a bridge between the US and China and help them solve their problems. If they can't solve it together, then we're just getting in the way. So it's silly to think in those terms. So we're not a bridge, but we can be a sensible, coherent, clear voice to both of them because of our economic relationship with one and our strategic alliance with the other. We can also be a sensible voice in regional affairs, whether it's the Pacific Island Forum or the Indian Ocean Rim Association or the ASEAN-related forums. And we can be a sensible voice in the United Nations committed to the rule of law and international order and the United Nations Charter. And we're very good at that. And for a small population country, sort of at the, you know, the last stop before New Zealand and Antarctica, we've done pretty well. And now, with the shift of economic growth to the Indian Ocean, we're now a two-ocean country. We're in Pacific Ocean this side, Indian Ocean on the other, and we are now right at the fulcrum of that joining between the Pacific and the Indian. If we play our cards right, particularly with Indonesia and India, then that'll do our security and our prosperity no end of good. Trump got himself elected, in my view, because people in America who lived outside of the main towns came to the conclusion that the American dream for them was over. They'd worked hard, but their kids had no chance of a job, no chance of buying a house or whatever. And so they voted for the person who looked most likely to stick it up the establishment and maybe give them a chance. We haven't suffered from that in Australia because we've managed to, and we have a much better equity system in place than the US do. But if our prosperity drops for our future generations, then the risk is that we do have those issues and those problems. So our ongoing prosperity is essential. And my view has always been we can only do that by continuing to be a great trading nation and a attractive place for overseas capital investment. The overseas investment always gets to a peak and then essentially plateaus, so you've got to find new forms of it. And so my analysis is it's all in the Indian Ocean, Indonesia, India, and ultimately, you know, way down the track, you'll still be doing shows, but I won't, you know, Africa. And so that's all in our part of the world, provided we make the Indian Ocean our part of the world, and we're capable of doing that with our diplomatic skills.
If you would like to ask Stephen a question, put your hand up, and if an usher puts a microphone in it, start talking.
I wanted to ask about the personal dimensions of diplomacy, which we read a lot about in the paper. For example, Trump recently said that he and Kim Jong-un had fallen in love. There was talk when Julie Bishop was ousted. One day she's foreign minister, the next day she's not. She lost a lot of the personal relationships that she had built up over time. To what extent does the emotional dimensions of diplomacy matter? Respect, admiration, animosity, fear for diplomats, not for publics?
Or even just plain knowing each other. We've had five foreign ministers in a decade, I think. Yeah.
Well, look, the personal stuff helps in the sense that you build relationships with your counterparts or with significant officials in other countries. And that means in the modern era, you know, you can get on the phone and speak to them, or you can you know, text. I'd have a half a dozen foreign ministers around the world who, you know, you'd text and have conversations with. Initially, the department used to hate that because you're having conversations that they never knew about. You know. But those personal relationships are, and whether it's a personal relationship between a couple of foreign ministers or a couple of UN ambassadors at the United Nations or generally, all of that helps. But never fall for the sucker punch. In the end, irrespective of the individual relationships, countries will act in what they perceive as their national interests. So you can ring up, you know, a person who you have a very good personal relationship with and say, we're about to decide that we're doing this, and if they think it's adverse to their relationship, the fact you could ring them up and tell them is a help. But in the end, their response will be, does this help or hinder our national interests? And most, we have this saying in diplomacy, you look at something and someone would say, okay, we're going to do that. This country here will be, you know, a problem. They won't like it. And then someone would say, yes, but Stephen, you can talk to them first and it'll be manageable. In other words, they won't like it, but it's not a deal breaker or a drop dead issue. And so the personal relationships help you manage things. But in the end, if you do something and another country doesn't like it, you know, then the personal relationships won't save it. You know, they talk about nation states because nation states act in their national interest. That's what we do, and that's what other countries do.
Yeah, Stephen, I'd like to unpack your love relationship or your love affair with trade. Obviously, some trade is essential, but Indonesia and Australia vie for the number one position in terms of the export of coal, which, of course, as I'm sure you know, contributes to greenhouse gas emissions. Is this perhaps one area of trade that we need to rethink in Australia and move into being a developer of renewable sources of energy, which we have heaps of here in this country?
Well, I think that's already occurring. So let me go right back in history. I'm for Australia, I'm a strong supporter of a country of 25 million people trading with the rest of the world because we can find big markets in our part of the world or beyond where Australians can sell their goods, world-class goods, products and services outside of a market which is very small. So just because I'm in favour of trade doesn't mean, for example, that I think that the trade of human beings in the slavery trade was a good thing. So there are some things that you can trade in which you say, well, that's actually not what we had in mind. So there are certain commodities which Australia has said we don't think trade in this area is a good idea. So tobacco, for example, is one thing where the government that I was a member of essentially said, you know, we want to do everything we can to close you down. So you shouldn't disparage the notion of trade because you can find, at any given time in history, you can find something, a commodity or a service which you regard as being offensive, unlawful, or just plain abhorrent. I think that so far as coal is concerned, Australia and other countries are starting to vote with their feet. We're already seeing, despite the great difficulty that governments have had recently in the energy and renewable area, the market is voting with its feet. I think in the end, and you've seen this with it won't be governments who say, we don't want that coal market occurring anymore. It'll be financiers and bankers who say, actually, we aren't going to be doing that because we're transparent, we've got shareholders, and no one wants us to be doing that. So you can't turn off coal tomorrow, but there'll come a point in the cycle where renewables and clean coal technology and transitional gas will provide the vast bulk of energy stocks. You know, and so you know, just because you support the notion of a country like Australia selling its wares overseas doesn't mean that you have to be into every commodity. You want to be into the goods, products and services that we can do in a competitive way. And whether it's healthcare services, whether it's engineering services, whether it's minerals expertise, whether it's education, you know, we are world class at a whole range of things despite our habit and practice in the domestic arena of criticising our capability in those areas.
Thanks. I've got a three questions, actually.
You're going to get one, because there's lots of people who want to ask one.
I'm just wondering why it is that you do not see the kind of danger that exists in terms of international relations between China and the United States. We have seen these kinds of historical periods before the First World War, when it actually eventuated or resulted in a hot war. Now, given the kind of agendas in the United States and so on, and perhaps in China as well, it's inevitable that there will be a clash. The other question
I'm going to let Stephen speak to this.
It's related. It's related to the fact of Palestine.
I am going to stop. Sorry, you've asked one, and we'll let our guest respond. Thanks.
Well, I don't think that I have or do underestimate the potential for difficulty. I said, in addition to a changing world, the two factors of consternation or disruption are uncertainty as a result of the Trump presidency and Chinese assertiveness as a result of a changed posture in Chinese terms. So, and we spoke at length about the risks and the dangers of misjudgment and miscalculation. So this is what those individual countries and the international community, you know, are very conscious of, and we need to make sure that a minor hiccup by a couple of small vessels doesn't turn into a conflagration. So I think we're only too well aware of that, and that's why we have the capacity to be a sensible voice to both sides of that, that there's a way in which we've got to try and manage these issues, and the uncertainty on one hand and the assertiveness on the other, you know, has made that exponentially more harder. And if we were having this conversation, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, we would still be talking in terms of what we used to call the responsible stakeholder. We're confident that China will emerge as a responsible stakeholder and it'll all be fine. We don't talk in those terms now because we know the game's tougher.
Mm. Thank you. What is the significance of the United States being so tardy in appointing an ambassador to Australia?
Well, the acting ambassador is a bloke by the name of Jim Caruso. I think he's a first-class diplomat. He's on his second stint to Australia. And from a personal point of view, I'd be happy if the administration made him ambassador overnight. So on the one hand, some people will say, you know, that we don't have a fully fledged ambassador. You know, that's terrible and shocking. I don't take that reaction. It was unfortunate in one respect that Harry Harris, who was nominated for Australia, was transferred to Seoul. Unfortunate for us in one respect, perhaps unfortunate for Harry, I'm not sure. I haven't had the conversation with him. But I'm not as angst about that as other people are. And again, I suppose you could use that franchise aspect. You know, we work very well with the Department of State and the mission, US mission in Canberra. We've been well served by a number of US ambassadors here that I've worked with personally and know. So John Berry, who was the last one, Jeff Blash, they were both terrific in different ways. Tom Schiefer, who was US ambassador here previously. So that, you know, that we've done well out of that. Some people read too much into it. Jim's doing a good job, and you could make him ambassador tomorrow and life would continue as normal.
Perhaps a little sort of that heads down as well, you know, not attracting too much attention to Australia.
One could say be careful what you wish for.
Yeah. got time for one more.
Hi, Stephen, I wondered if you'd like to comment on the recent events with Russia and the UK over the Skripal affair and the other one that's blown up in the last week with Saudi Arabia. Just what your perspective is on that type of activity from nations. Yeah.
Well, deal with Russia/UK first and then Saudi Arabia. I mean, neither of them are easy issues. I think the first point to make is that we don't have much of a relationship with Russia, neither an economic relationship nor a strategic or diplomatic relationship. And when I was a minister, about the only contact I had with the Russians other than pro forma meetings with their foreign or deputy foreign affairs minister or defence ministers was to make sure that a few Russian sailors who overstayed their, let their visa expire when they were doing research work, genuine research work in the Antarctic, that they you know, were slipped through Australia and got home for Christmas. So we don't have much of a relationship. Russia is a disruptive force, and you find that disruption most in Europe and the UK. And Putin is a disruptive, assertive sort of fellow. So that's hard for NATO and the Europeans and the United States to manage. And we're, in a sense, spectators. We have no influence, you know, on those areas. But I think, you know, if it's a choice between who do you support or who do you believe, well, I'm with the Brits. You know, it's quite easy on the available evidence. The Saudi Arabia thing is complex, largely because with the Vienna Convention, the Turks can't send the police or the troops in to do over the consulate because we have a thing called diplomatic immunity. But that one, you know, is deeply disturbing. Despite all of the difficulties we've had in the relationship between nation states and regions over the decades, generally the notion of diplomatic immunity and the proper treatment, the proper utilisation of diplomatic missions in countries has been widely respected. Sure, there's been the occasional person doing intelligence or spying activity that wasn't properly declared and the like, and people have been kicked out. But we haven't seen something where, unless there is a proper explanation, one is led on the balance of probabilities to the conclusion that something terrible occurred in a Saudi Arabian consulate in Turkey, which is basically Saudi soil in Turkey, which the Turks can't do a great deal about unless the Saudis waive it. So you've got some important Vienna Convention and diplomatic principles there, but both of them are very bad signs. So the Russian activity in the UK is abhorrent to the Brits and on any measure abhorrent. And if half of what is alleged occurred in the Saudi consulate, then that's abhorrent too and a disturbing sign. And we just need to keep our head about these things, conduct ourselves in the way that we always have, continue to impress upon other countries the principles that we abide by, and and hopefully add to sensible regional and international decisions which work for the world and work for a rules-based order and work for a small country like Australia, who's done pretty well out of all of that.
Thank you all for your questions, and sorry if you didn't get a chance to ask one. There's so many questions I would still have liked to have asked as well. The time has gone so fast, and I feel like we've just sort of touched on things, but in hearing where your emphasis is, Stephen, it I think gives me and the audience a sense of where to look, where to think about, where to put our own emphasis in thinking about Australia's relationships with the world and how we might be tracking. It has been fascinating. Just appreciate so much that you would fly all this way to the lovely Wheeler Centre to come and talk to us tonight, and we really do appreciate it. So thank you, and thank you all for coming.
Thanks. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Stephen Smith in conversation with Sally Warhaft for The Fifth Estate. If you enjoy this series, why not check out our other podcasts at wheelercentre.com. The Wheeler Centre podcast features recordings of talks on all topics all year round. Better Off Dead, hosted by Andrew Denton, explores the question of euthanasia law in Australia. And the Walkley Award-winning podcast The Messenger takes us into immigration detention on Manus Island to find out what life there is really like. You'll find those series and more at wheelercentre.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, take care.